You are listening to an exclusive podcast on Money Control.
First things first, not a single vote has been counted. All we have are predictions. That said, Helen Reagan wrote today in CNN that Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is well on course to win a second term after polling in the world's biggest election came to a close on Sunday. She went on to add, initial exit polls suggest. That's important to know. Initial exit polls suggest. She went on to write, and I quote, most major exit polls conducted by local media put the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party, that is the BJP, led by Modi, and its National Democratic Alliance, that is the coalition NDA, as winning a clear majority when results are announced on the 23rd of May. Modi's BJP has been fighting it out for the votes of 900 million people against the main opposition Congress Party, led by political scion Rahul Gandhi and other big regional players, over the course of 6 weeks of polling. A party needs to win 272 seats out of 543 in the Lok Sabha or the lower house of parliament to form a government. Unquote. Now, those are the words to a foreign audience, but you know all of this already. For Modi, India's marathon election ends where it all began, she says, adding that in 2014, BJP stormed to power by winning 282 Lok Sabha seats in what was the biggest majority secured by a single party in 30 years. She also adds that the release of the polls came right after Modi had spent the day meditating in a Himalayan holy cave and offered prayers at the Kedarnath temple in the Garhwal region of Uttarakhand. That cave looked nice. You can hire it for 990 rupees a day. I plan to do it. So, we can presume that the whole scenario fits neatly into a supplication and manifestation template. The CNN piece, of course, does not say that, but it does say that the six-week-long election has essentially been a referendum on the government policies over the past 5 years. CNN went on to say, Modi's 2014 victory was in part due to his promises to overhaul India's economy and generate jobs for young people, around 12 million of whom enter the workforce every year. Initial exit polls suggest that voters have not been turned off by a worsening job situation, a fall in farmers' wages, and a rise in far-right Hindu nationalism. It appears, this is me saying, that people are voting not in spite of, but in some cases because of those things. They put Modi's coalition as winning between 277 and a whopping 365 seats. She went on to say the polls, if true, would mark something of a surprise. The outcome of the election was expected to be tight, with commentators repeatedly pointing out just how close the contest would be between the incumbent ruling party and the various regional challengers. But on Sunday, the BJP tweeted a cartoon showing Modi mowing down his opponents after the seven phases of polling. But to repeat what I began the podcast with, the results of the 2019 general elections are not yet out. But you would not know that if you turned on your TV set right now or tuned into any social media platform. If the majority of exit polls are to be believed, then we're right in the middle of an all-consuming saffron wave, and the NDA is all set to walk into history with a thumping majority for another term. At the time of my recording this, the BSE Sensex is at 39,332. That's almost 1,400 points up. And it is a similar story with the Nifty 50 as well. Almost 410 points up. But even when such exit polls are touted as authoritative, are there not obvious problems with the premise that projections have sometimes become more important than facts in a democracy? Don't we need to know the actual verdict before jumping to conclusions about who won and who lost, and why? It doesn't seem like it if the euphoric news anchors are to be believed. So we will do our bit and dive deep on this edition of Decoding 2019 into contrarian views to give a bit of texture to the story. Can we believe the exit polls, first of all? How often have exit polls been right? How often have they been wrong? But if all exit polls coming out are indicating the same thing, should we at least believe in the trend? And just where and when did the tradition of exit polls begin in this country? These are the questions we'll be answering, but to give you a quick overview of what different exit polls are saying, India Today has the NDA pegged at 339 to 365 seats. That is the highest number that has been given to the coalition by any exit poll. The lowest is the Netha NewsX poll, which pegs BJP Plus, that is the NDA, at 242. Our own News 18 exit poll suggests the number is 336, a comfortable majority for the NDA. Several of the polls are also showing that the South is holding out, although Karnataka, many people claim, is going to be a clean sweep for the BJP. And in those states where the Congress emerged victorious in the recently concluded assembly polls, what we're seeing is yet again the BJP gaining the most number of seats. And West Bengal, where people had said the BJP could not get more than 2 seats, most exit polls are suggesting at least double digits, with the India Today poll suggesting 19 to 23 seats in comparison to the 19 to 22 seats for the TMC. So, what are the exit polls saying and what are the answers to the questions I raised earlier will be the subjects of this edition of Decoding 2019. It's the Exit Poll Special. My name is Rakesh Sharma and you're listening to Money Control.
The Deep Dive Podcast Series. Most exit polls claim an NDA sweep, but can you believe them?
We've all heard of the saying, to err is human, to forgive divine. Putting a spin on it, Rahul Verma once wrote in an essay where he said, to err is human and to err again and again is to be a pollster in India. So it is a notoriously difficult task to conduct exit polls or opinion polls in India. First of all, the diversity. You need to have a good sample size for a country like ours. Dorab Supariwala and Pranoy Roy, in their book The Verdict, go on to say that as a rule of thumb, the sample size for all India polls should be an average of at least 1,500 to 2,000 respondents per state for each of the 18 major states. So at least 1,500 to 2,000 people for each of the 18 major states, which corresponds to about 35,000 respondents across the country. Now, this 1,500 to 2,000 rule of thumb is an average figure. Size matters when it comes to heterogeneity, and so some of the really big states like Uttar Pradesh should perhaps have a sample of 3,000 to 4,000 respondents, while smaller, more homogeneous states can do with 1,000, is what they have to say. And they also say that it depends on the closeness and the uncertainty of the fight. If the average margin of victory in the previous election was large and the state looks like an easy win for one party, which is 20% ahead, it may permit a slightly smaller number. But if the margin was much smaller, you would do better with a higher sample size. There are, of course, several issues that dog sophology in this country. The expectation of precision is, first of all, already too much to ask for. And while the preferences that we may have for political parties are quite stable throughout, there are enough number of voters who switch parties very frequently. And also in the Natak and the Tamasha, that is India, where we have the first past the post electoral system, with several parties competing and changing their pre-poll alliances in every successive election, it means that forecasting in India is as much a science as it is an art, because whatever numbers we end up getting must also be interpreted in the context of India's diverse polity and society. Rahul Verma also says pretty much the same thing. There are, of course, several other issues when it comes to why polling is difficult in India, but we'll get to that a little later. So, in India, let's establish first and foremost that polling is very, very hard. Having said that, I should also talk about a few numbers here before we talk about anything else. Pranoy Roy, one of the best-known names in sophology in the country, and Dorab Supariwala, in their book The Verdict, go on to say this, and I quote, "Opinion polls for Lok Sabha elections are as reliable as exit polls. The strike rate for both exit and opinion polls for the Lok Sabha is very high, at 97% each, matching global standards." So while it is all too easy to dismiss exit polls as merely projections, like I did right at the beginning of the podcast, it is also important to remember that several times, sophologists have in fact got it right. Of course, in recent times, they have come under much fire, especially in the context of the American presidential elections, where every single poll, except I think the one by LA Times, had predicted a win for Hillary Clinton. And yes, she did indeed win more number of seats than Donald Trump did, but it did not convert to an electoral college seat share. We also saw a similar thing happen with the Brexit referendum in the United Kingdom. And closer home in India, we've seen it in 2004, with the India Shining campaign of the BJP going horribly wrong and Vajpayee not coming into power. We've also seen the challenge of converting votes into seats. Several of the polls get the vote share of the party right, but cannot quite get the seat share right. Take, for example, the Karnataka 2008 polls, where the Congress had 34.6% of the vote share and won 80 seats, whereas the BJP had 33.9% vote share, that is less than the Congress, and had 110 seats. Or Kerala in 1996, where the UDF had 44.4% of the vote share and got 59 seats, whereas the LDF had lesser vote share, that is 42.7%, but got 78 seats. So there is this challenge of converting votes into seats as well. We'll get into the nitty-gritties of these exit polls in just a little while, but I also want to find out what the origin of these exit polls were. The first election surveys can in fact be traced all the way back to 1957, before the second Lok Sabha elections. Eric DaCosta then had conducted an All India poll. The survey then had not only predicted the outcome, but also had spoken about the variation in voting intentions based on various demographics, be it income, be it religion, be it region. As early as 1957, we had already established what the patterns of voters across these different demographics were. In the 1960s, it was the pioneering work at the Center for the Study of Developing Societies, that is CSDS in New Delhi, which gave opinion polling an academic turn, as Rahul Verma states in his essay, which is collected in The Great March of Democracy, a book that I would suggest that you read. A Hindustan Times correspondent has shared some trivia about these exit polls, and they also talk about the pioneering work of CSDS in the 1960s, when it was a team led by Rajni Kothari who had done some pioneering work when it comes to election polling. But at least as far as contemporary Indian memory goes, it is in the 1980s when we started seeing serious media poll surveys. And that was the time of sophologist Pranoy Roy teaming up with David Butler. Their sophisticated analyses of the elections of 1984, 1989 and the 1991 Lok Sabha elections is pretty much what set the template for election polling here in India. Their studies back in the 80s also resulted in a book called The Compendium of Indian Elections by Pranoy Roy, David Butler and Ashok Lahiri. The election studies program, meanwhile, at CSDS was also revived in 1995 under the Lok Niti Network. The National Election Studies Surveys, that is NES surveys, by this network, that is the Lok Niti Network, was primarily conducted to undertake an in-depth analysis of voting behavior. But, as Rahul Verma goes on to say, as the data on voting preferences was collected before the counting day, these data were also used for forecasting votes as well as seats. Now, with the explosion of satellite television in the 90s came in TV news channels and many, many more polls. Satellite television lent exit polls blockbuster prominence since the state-run Doordarshan's commissioning of a countrywide exit poll in 1996 to CSDS. And after that came the Star News and the NDTVs and the CNN IBNs and now the glut and the glut of networks and therefore the glut of exit polls and opinion polls that we have today. Exit polls, for obvious reasons, are not allowed to be telecast before polling. That's because you don't want to influence the voter one way or another. And according to Section 126 of the Representation of the People's Act 1951, exit polls are banned from the beginning of the polls until half an hour after the final phase of voting has been held. So as of Sunday yesterday, it was at about 6:30 or 6:45 that we started getting a sense of these numbers. The next question we ask ourselves, could the exit poll numbers be exaggerated? Kamini Gupta, who is a social scientist and lecturer at King's College in London, tries to answer that very question on a Huffington Post piece. And she begins by contextualizing the exit poll results. She says, and I quote, "In the aftermath of the Balakot airstrikes in February 2019, national security superseded all other issues as the number one priority for many Indians. In the weeks following the airstrikes, Prime Minister Modi saw a huge upsurge in his approval ratings, rising from 32% in the beginning of the year to over 60%. Entering the election season on the back of that momentum, BJP was expected to comfortably win the national elections and form the government. This expectation has now been reinforced by the exit poll results, which predict, of course, that the BJP-led NDA will easily form the government. But what are we missing in this picture? How accurate can political soothsaying be anywhere in the world, but particularly in a country as demographically layered and diverse as India, where, as Kamini rightly points out, polling takes place over 7 phases and takes more than a month? She says, and I quote, "Even though exit polls suggest that the BJP will comfortably form a government, leaving the Congress far behind, recent electoral surprises have warned us not to take anything for granted. Both Brexit and the American election results were a surprise, where exit polls, sophologists and popular media had all predicted that the Remain camp and Hillary Clinton, respectively, would win. Just this weekend, we've seen Australians were in for a surprise as the country's ruling coalition defied exit polls to defeat the Labour Party." Unquote. In fact, like I said earlier, a comparison between exit polls and the final results for India have known to get it wrong. And why is that so? Why is there sometimes a divergence between the actual results and what the exit polls show? Kamini cites a reason. This is called the spiral of silence, which is a powerful theory proposed by German political scientist Elisabeth Noelle Neumann, which has been credited for some of the surprise results we have seen in the recent past. According to Kamini, the theory argues that people who believe that they hold the minority view on public issues are less likely to voice them due to fear of being excluded by others. Take, for example, if you happen to watch Game of Thrones but actually hate it, you don't often end up saying that in front of people because, you know, it's a minority view and you'd much rather not voice it because the other majority view, which seems to love it, is so loud. This leads to the perceived gap between the views appearing larger than they actually are. So this is the question she poses to us. Could we be expecting a similar spiral of silence to be operating in India? She recalls Tejasvi Surya, who's BJP's candidate from Bangalore South, my constituency, who had proclaimed in a speech a few days before he was given the party ticket, he had said, "This election is going to be the test of a common man's patriotism. If you're with Modi, you're with India. And if you're not with Modi, you are anti-India." Unquote. Now, Kamini points out that this widely shared and repeated rhetoric pushes people into being silent and not really expressing their real views. When electoral preferences become a test of patriotism, she argues, one is bound to feel worried about revealing what their true preferences are. She says, BJP is argued to be tougher on voices that go against it, making the fear of isolation even stronger for people who don't support it. She believes that there are two reasons to expect that we may be overestimating the support for BJP. The first is the spiral of silence theory, which takes into account those who may be afraid of voicing their opinion if they believe that their belief is in a minority. She says, currently in India, the Modi camp is far more vocal. That is because of several reasons. First, as the party in power and one with vastly more campaign funding, the BJP has way more control over the narrative and what reaches the masses. As a side note, I should remind you also that they have the best social media machinery of any party in the country in the history of the country. She went on to say, under the current government, press freedom has declined, and the media has been used to spread the official line on the government's achievements. Essentially, they have the power to amplify voices that support them. Unquote. Therefore, non-supporters may feel like they hold the minority view and put themselves in a spiral of silence and don't end up saying whom they voted for when asked during an exit poll. Now, that is one theory. Now, the second theory is something I've already alluded to. The belief is that the incumbent government is argued to be tougher on voices that go against it, making this fear of isolation even stronger for people who don't support it. So, even more silence. She quotes the Prime Minister when he told Prasoon Joshi this, "I want this government to be criticized. Criticism makes democracy strong. Democracy cannot succeed without constructive criticism." Those were the Prime Minister's words. But as Kamini says, and I quote her again, the government has shown itself to be intolerant of dissenting voices, and common people have been arrested for merely criticizing Modi on the street or posting on Facebook. In addition, cases of mob lynchings and violence have dramatically increased, and therefore the fear is not only of social exclusion, but even of physical harm. Unquote. She also takes into account the reluctant Congress voter who's not as vociferous as the Modi supporters in the face of rhetoric such as "if not Modi, then who," which dares people to name Rahul Gandhi or anyone else as a credible contender. And as Kamini points out, in these elections, what may be important is not only the voter who has a clear preference between BJP and Congress, but also the one who doesn't. She says, in a major pre-poll survey, only 67% of the respondents clearly picked either Modi or Rahul Gandhi as their prime ministerial candidate. 18% expressed support for other leaders and 15% simply did not respond. Who these people vote for will also depend on whom they dislike less rather than whom they like more. That is more important because that kind of voter is particularly less likely to clearly endorse one candidate and, more importantly, make their view public, which is why sometimes these exit polls can be quite hard to assess because there is that 15% of the voting public, a significant chunk, which simply does not want to talk about it for the other reasons I mentioned. So there are some crucial things that we end up missing out on when we're trying to do some exit polling. as Pranoy Roy mentions in his book, and as you can find in this set of essays that I'm reading, that the Indian voter does not generally trust the person who's doing the polling. Pranoy Roy talks about this. He says, voters are worried mainly about two things. First, is the field worker, that is the one who's taking these responses from these people, is he in any way linked to the authorities, and would an honest response visit adverse consequences on them? So this is something we've already spoken about. That's one worry that the voter has. Now the second one, they're also anxious that their answers may become public knowledge. This is also something we've spoken about. Being interviewed is first of all rare in India, and interviewed in privacy is something virtually impossible in the context of India. The interview process, in fact, attracts a whole bunch of bystanders, and you may never be sure that the answer that you're getting from the respondent is accurate or not. In this context, actually, Pranoy Roy goes on to say a really interesting story. The concept of privacy, or pretty much the lack of it in India, is something that a psychiatrist apparently told Pranoy Roy. This psychiatrist had apparently just returned from the US after practicing there, etc., and began using the same techniques here in India. He would call his patients into the room, one at a time, ask them questions about their problems, and he found, funnily enough, that his patients were actually reluctant to answer, and the patient would keep looking back over their shoulder at the rest of the family in the waiting area. So one day, this psychiatrist decided that he would call in the family along with the patient, and when surrounded by the family, the patient opened up and answered even the most intimate questions in great detail in front of the family. So, Pranoy Roy and Dorab Suparivala go on to say that with opinion polling, if a voter is being questioned privately with no familiar faces around, the field worker is likely to get fewer and less straightforward answers than if the respondent is in the presence of family and friends. So this sort of counterintuitive behavior is also something that we need to keep in mind when we're trying to do polling here in India. So it's not just about the numbers, it's also about understanding Indians' sensibilities, which would strike to a Western observer as extremely counterintuitive. Coming back to the question at hand, are these projections far from the ground reality? The DNA Web team also came up with a piece in the aftermath of the exit polls and cites instances when they've got it wrong, not just once, but many times. The team went on to write, and I quote, "All exit polls need to carry the standard statutory warning. This might not reflect reality." In 2004, the exit polls thought the BJP-led NDA would return post the India Shining campaign, and we all remember how that turned out. In 2009, the exit polls did predict a UPA win, but failed to catch the swing in Congress's favor, with the grand old party ending up with 61 more seats than it did in 2004. Exit polls are exactly how they sound. People walking out of polling booths and they're asked how they voted. Those data are then added up to compute a party's possible vote share, and from which a party's possible seat share is extrapolated. This is all mathematics going on. In the 1999 elections, brought about by an early collapse of Vajpayee's government, some of the polls gave the NDA 315 plus seats, while others said it would fall short of the halfway mark of 272. It eventually ended up somewhere in the middle with 298. In 2014, again, the exit polls didn't completely pick up the swing, this time in Modi's favor. Most gave the NDA far less than the 336 that the NDA eventually won. I have told you earlier that more often than not, the exit polls for the Lok Sabha elections in India have turned out to be right. But there are important exceptions, and I must mention them because that is part of my job. In the Delhi Assembly elections of 2015, for example, no one quite had gauged the size of the Aam Aadmi Party's landslide. AAP was predicted to win like 31 to 53 seats in the 70-member assembly. The range for the BJP was in fact 17 to 35. What actually happened? Aam Aadmi Party got 67 seats and the BJP got 3. And that was a case where the exit polls simply did not see it coming. In Bihar in 2015, same year, again, exit polls had predicted a tight contest between the Mahagathbandhan and the BJP. The grand alliance of the JDU, the RJD and the Congress finally ended up with 178 seats in the 243-member house. Clearly, not even a close contest. In Uttar Pradesh in 2017, which was an election fought less than 6 months after demonetization, if you remember, the exit polls had actually predicted a hung house. In the end, the BJP swept the election. It won 312 seats. The full strength of the UP Assembly is 403. That's just 109 seats short of a full house. As the DNA piece went on to say, the big problem with exit polls is how they make the jump from vote to seat share. we already spoke about this in some detail. It's always the danger for pollsters in the first-past-the-post system. They state another example of how tricky it can get. In 2009, the Congress's vote share increased by just about 2%, but they added 61 seats in comparison to the outcome of the election in 2004, and the vote share difference was just 2%. That is the trouble. In this first-past-the-post system, when you have more than two parties contesting, even a slight change in vote share can make predicting an election result super difficult. Finally, of course, there is the fact that exit polls sometimes play up certain sections of voters. That is, they seem to be more comfortable sampling the urban, rich, and upper-caste voter while ignoring the others. In some other studies, this is more obvious. Those who get interviewed in an exit poll tend to be more forthcoming, meaning their personality is like that. They tend to be male. They tend to be from the upper strata of Indian society, among many other such characteristics. So, when it comes to sampling, the urban versus rural divide, the affluent versus non-affluent divide, the caste representative samples, in a good poll, all of these divisions will be accounted for. You would interview people from different strata of society. You would look at what caste they belong to. You would look at which region they're from. You would look at what religion they belong to. In a good poll, all of these things need to be taken into account. But unfortunately, those good polls are few and far between in the country. Otonu Bishash, who is a professor at Indian Statistical Institute, Kolkata, wrote in the Economic Times that ever since the first exit poll was conducted in a local election in Kentucky in the United States in 1967, it has been a history of controversy and entertainment for exit polls. He says, and I quote, "The sorry state of exit polls is illustrated again and again in India, where many of the popular exit poll results fail to predict the final result with reasonable accuracy. No wonder people tend to treat them as pure entertainment. There is enough doubt on the techniques and sample sizes of many polling organizations. Even if the sampling is random and representative of the population and the sample sizes are adequate, other kinds of errors exist, including non-response biases." He offers an example. Suppose we have two contestants, A and B. Now let us presume that A's support is 55% and B's is 45%. Assume that 40% of A's supporters and 60% of B's supporters participated in the survey. Among a sample population of 20,000, that means 11,000 and 9,000 supporters of A and B respectively. So, 4,400 supporters of A and 5,400 supporters of B took part in the survey and predicted a victory for B. But that is in fact not the case. A won the contest. According to the writer, this was the case as believed by pollsters like Warren Mitofsky, who is the inventor of exit polls, with Democratic candidate John Kerry in the exit polls of the US presidential election of 2004. Although Kerry was predicted to win by Mitofsky's exit poll, as we all know, George W. Bush won again. As Otonu went on to say, a small-scale survey prior to the exit poll could be attempted to estimate the percentages of the supporters of A and B who would be interested to participate in the poll. A properly designed and executed pre-exit poll survey may actually yield closer numbers. In addition, respondents often lie to pollsters, sometimes due to what is known as a social desirability bias. They pretend to make the politically correct choice to the pollster without admitting their support to some controversial leader or party. They may even be afraid of admitting their support due to local political conditions, preferring to come across as riding the bandwagon. For example, 28% Latinos in the United States supported Donald Trump, though the Republican candidate had said some horrible things about the community in his campaign. If you recall, right, the very first speech he made when he came down the elevator in Trump Tower was that Mexico sends their worst people across the border. They're rapists, they're murderers, etc. And you would have imagined that the entire Latino community would have voted against him. But quietly, 28% of them did in fact vote for Donald Trump. Otonu also explains another statistical technique called randomized response sampling, which can be used to estimate the actual proportions supporting different parties. Now, with two parties, he says, it may be implemented with the question, did you vote for party A? Now, the second question you would tag on to that is your birthday between January and June? Now, the second question has a 50% chance of a yes response and the unlikelihood of the respondent lying about it. The pollster can then estimate the proportion of voters who voted for a particular party more accurately. Let me make that clear for you. by quoting him. If 1,000 respondents are interviewed and 480 yes responses are obtained for the first question, about half of them, that's about 250, replied yes to the second question about being born between January and June. So there were 230 odd remaining yes replies for the first question. This means that about 230 of the 500, that is about 46%, voted for party A. Does that make sense? But in a multi-party setup like India's, suitable modifications of this technique can be implemented, he says. So why not implement such techniques in exit polls? Understandably, he says, it demands more effort and more time, both for collecting and analyzing the data, delaying the announcement of exit poll results by at least a few hours. But isn't that better than announcing possible erroneous results that tend to be increasingly hilarious over time? Is the question he asks. The other question we need to address here also is the cost of conducting these polls. The polling industry mostly works on a cost per interview model. The current rate is anywhere between 100 rupees to 700 rupees. The main reason for such a huge variation, according to Rahul Verma, is that while fly-by-night operators have low overhead costs, established research firms have significant overhead costs towards infrastructure, towards staff, and hiring competent people to do the interviews. There's a lot of overhead there. And if you want the turnaround time to be less, because, you know, you obviously want the results as fast as you can, you also need to put more people, more feet on the ground, and that costs more money. And this is the kind of money a lot of the polling firms that contribute to all of these networks simply are not willing to spend. So there are all these issues that we need to bear in mind before truly believing the results of exit polls. And I keep repeating what Pranoy Roy said: in about 97% of the cases, the trend that these exit polls have shown has been right in the Lok Sabha polls in India. The numbers might have varied, but the trends have been right. The other important question that we ask ourselves, are they accurate? We've said many times that they're not accurate, but let's find out what some specialists have to say. The Hindustan Times said, and I quote, "Critics and political parties say the agencies that conduct the exit polls could be biased in terms of the choice and words, timing of the questions, the methodology they use, and the kind of sample they draw. The sample group's demographic behavior, its economic status, and various other factors used in tabulating the survey are also questioned. Political parties also allege that exit polls are funded by their rivals and may not reflect the sentiment or views of the people accurately." Unquote. As the piece points out, results of elections in India can be extremely hard to predict, and there have been instances when predictions have gone awry, as in the case of at least four Lok Sabha elections, where exit polls have offered huge inaccuracies, barring those in 98 and 2014 general elections. Two back-to-back flawed predictions, that is 2004 and 2009, had posed a question mark on their reliability. Most news agencies have reported how Vice President Venkaiah Naidu himself, in a surprising turn of events, mocked exit polls and said that most have gone wrong since 1999. He said, and I quote, "Exit polls do not mean exact polls. We have to understand that. Since 99, most of the exit polls have gone wrong." Now, should we then wait for the 23rd to make final assumptions? It seems logical, doesn't it? West Bengal Chief Minister and TMC Chief Mamata Banerjee also predictably tweeted that she did not trust exit poll gossip and that the game plan was to manipulate or replace thousands of voting machines through this gossip. She appealed to all opposition parties to be united, to be strong and bold. She said, "We will fight this battle together." Omar Abdullah, on the other hand, said, "Not every single poll can be wrong. If all of them are showing a trend towards an NDA victory, it's time to turn off the television and go to bed." To which Shashi Tharoor fired back saying, "Don't believe it. Just see the recent example of what happened in Australia." Which brings me to, before I conclude the podcast, what are the numbers saying? I've given you reasons as to why to take exit polls with a pinch of salt. I've also told you what Pranoy Roy and Suparivala think about the accuracy of these exit polls. And I've also given you instances of where they have gone wrong. The only thing we're attempting to do here is to offer you a balanced perspective. And let's find out now, finally, what these different polls are saying about the elections. Basically, nearly every single exit poll has predicted the BJP and the NDA would win these elections. By now, you know this. Sanjay Dhingra of The Print shares how a number of private agencies and media organizations like Today's Chanakya, ABP Sea Voter, NewsX Neta, Republic Jan Ki Baat, Republic Sea Voter, ABP CSDS, News 18 Ipsos, India Today Axis, Times Now CNX, and Chintamani have each claimed to predict the decision of 900 million voters with maximum accuracy. Sanjay went on to write, to conduct an exit poll, a random sample size is first selected. The sample size could be anywhere between 25,000 voters to 7 to 8 lakh voters, unquote. The piece went on to cite Pranav Gupta, who is a PhD student at the University of California, Berkeley, who says that while it is not necessary that all 543 constituencies are surveyed in order to accurately predict the results, some agencies actually survey as few as half the constituencies, it is still important that the sample size is geographically, socially, and demographically representative. A lot of the times, people can get exit polls wrong because the sample size was not representative. For example, they only went to urban areas or did not ask Muslim voters or voters of a particular caste, etc. The piece went on to say that the number of constituencies and the sample size to be surveyed are typically decided on the basis of the budget available with each agency. Like I told you earlier, these are all CPI model interviews, cost per interview models, and the budget can run up to several crores of rupees. Each interview could be anywhere between 80 to 100 to 300 to 400 rupees. This is according to Sanjay, whereas Rahul Verma thinks the upper scale of these interview payments could be as high as 700 rupees. The tricky part, as Sanjay says, is converting these vote share into seats. It is this conversion that sets apart a sophologist from a hack, including several journalists who may claim to know the mood of the nation. How does vote share translate to seat share? According to Gupta, the reasons for the inaccuracy of exit polls include voters lying about who they actually voted for, the absence of random and representative sampling, biases in questioning, or simply bad fieldwork. Gupta argues that data fudging on part of the agencies or channels in order to reinforce allegiance to a certain party can also be a reason. He says, and I quote, "Experts say the problem lies not with the ability of exit polls to predict the number of seats correctly, but the lack of scientific guidelines, methodological protocols, and transparency in how they are conducted. Agencies do not disclose how they conduct the exit polls, their methods, the demographic breakup of their sample size, etc. They don't say all these things. In the absence of this, it becomes very difficult," he says, "for us to even use this information." Unquote. You came to hear this, I'm going to tell you this. Times Now has 306 for the BJP, Chanakya 350, India Today 339 to 365, News 18 336, Sea Voter 287, ABP Nielsen 267, News Nation 282 to 290, Netha NewsX 242, that is the lowest that the NDA has received from any of these exit polls, India News 287, Janki Baat 305. The stock market clearly likes what has been predicted in the exit polls. The BSE Sensex, 39,352.67 at the end of the trading day, up 1,421 points. That's 3.75% up. Similar story with the Nifty 50 as well, 11,822.25, just about 30 points short of its lifetime high, up 3.69%. That was the end of the trading day today.
The Deep Dive podcast series. Most exit polls claim an NDA sweep, but can you believe them?
So a pinch of salt may be in order while we wait for the penny to drop on the 23rd, because like I said right at the beginning, not a single vote has been counted as of now. And we'll watch in real time if the country has voted for change or for incumbency. And what the opposition was saying about agrarian distress, unemployment rates being very high, the effects of demonetization, poor GST execution, all of these things, have they mattered at all to the Indian voter, or has it been a vote for Modi yet again? Do write into us, mcpodcast@nw18.com. Until the next time you hear from me, this is me, Rakesh Sharma, saying thank you for joining us, and do stay with us on moneycontrol.com to be a smart listener and an even smarter investor.
This has been a Digging Deeper podcast, and you have been listening to Money Control.